the Pilot TV podcast this week, we're taking a look at the dark side of surveillance culture in BBC One's The Capture, exploring a real-life crime story in ITV's A Confession, witnessing the birth of a monster in Fox News' origin story The Loudest Voice, and enjoying some bite-sized marital strife from Nick Hornby in State of the Union. Plus, Cara Delevingne and Orlando Bloom stop by to talk about fairies. I'm James Dyer, and welcome to the Pilot TV podcast, a show that not only went off the rails last week, but was sent crashing through people's houses before careening off a cliff as all discipline was lost and Ben Travis was allowed on here to start banging on about reality TV, for which I can but apologise. It's back to business this week, though, and rest assured that I have most soundly read Ben to filth for his crimes. Joining me on the podcast this week as I return from the US in my new role as public enemy number one are two fellow members of the fake news media. To my left, a woman who continues to spread lies, besmirching the good name of Farscape and spreading untruths about science fiction in general. It's Terry, pants on fire, White. Hello.
Hi, James. How long do we have to wait until we can talk about what happened?
But then that would be as if there's only two of us in the room and no one would suspect that there's another third member of the team.
Continue.
So I should, before we move on, say that to my right is a man who expects you to swallow towering monoliths of misinformation, peddling such howling whoppers as the idea that, I don't know, Daenerys somehow earned her fire and fury moment in the Bells episode of Game of Thrones. It's Boyd, the big little liar, Hilton.
Wow. Hello. Welcome back, the conquering hero.
Thanks.
Of journalism.
It's been emotional.
What was that phrase again? I still don't understand what thing to filth.
Read you to filth.
I still don't know what it means.
No, neither do I. But I listened to the podcast when I wasn't here and it was a thing.
No, it was, yeah.
Still a thing. But Ben did something wrong earlier today. And
did you read him to filth?
Like your pupil.
He did something wrong earlier today and we were having a WhatsApp exchange about it. And he said, I'm fully prepared to get read to filth. And he totally took all the heat out of the situation.
Yeah. Because he's a smart kid.
How can I bollock him after that?
Yeah. I ended up
just sending him a RuPaul gif.
Oh.
Totally,
I should have thought
that.
when you took me into a room to bollock me as well. Okay, good. So, yes, that was... I missed the 50th podcast. Last week's was the 50th Pilot TV podcast, and I fucking missed
it. Well, so here's the thing. I thought it was a year, so I went and did some research. And actually, it should have been our year, but we put back the first recording by a couple of weeks. So it's in 2 weeks' time.
Okay.
And I was like, oh, my God, wouldn't it be amazing if it's the year anniversary? When James isn't here, we can make a big thing out of it. Little did I know that we were missing the 50th episode.
Yeah, that was the 50th.
Until we uploaded it.
It should have been some kind of event. And in many ways it was, but just, you know, not the kind I had in mind.
So come on then.
Hi.
Let's cut to the chase.
So yeah.
Tell us.
I may have had some difficulties. So yes, as people may have heard on A, my Twitter feed, or B, Newsweek, The Washington Post, The Independent, and a number of other outlets.
The Daily Mail.
Yeah, we don't talk about them. Also, I think it should characterise the fact that most people asked me for a quote, they didn't, and also got a fact wrong. And I was
my favourite coverage was in the Daily Mail, of course. You were kind of in the sidebar of shame, first of all, as a big showbiz story. And the headline in the Daily Mail said something like, blah, 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 I'm paraphrasing, British journalist gets in trouble on the border and he's only there to review Star Wars.
Yeah.
So, where's your review of Star Wars?
Yeah. Well, that was the fact that I was talking about. Yeah.
I mean, we're all waiting.
You got to review a film that isn't finished, all I'm saying.
Let me tell you, that gave me the most fear. I was like, oh my God, they've used the R word.
I know.
He's not reviewing.
He's not reviewing. God help us.
Where did they get your photo from?
They took that photo off my Facebook page without asking me.
Unbelievable.
Although I give massive props to the website in America, I can't remember the name of it, who their pit research, they went to my Twitter timeline, didn't go very far, and it's a picture of me with two Infinity Gauntlets on, which
that
is the best thing ever.
Yes.
I think Washington Post might have used that one as well, one of their little...
I mean, it wouldn't surprise me. Yeah. That's how I'm due to be remembered now. It's like double Thanos. Also the worst part of the Daily Mail article is, and the most mortifying part of this whole thing, so I should say, what happened essentially was, I arrived in America, as you do. I went to customs, I went to the desk. They said, essentially, give me your passport. I gave him my visa, so I have a journalist visa. I gave that to them, and he said, what do you do? I said, I'm a journalist, and he looked at me and basically said, you're part of the fake news media. And it was like,
Gee, and I just assumed, obviously, as you would, that he's joking. But then he said, have you ever worked for CNN or MSNBC? I was like, no. I write about, you know, the film things and the TV. And he went off on one about how the fake news media is destroying American democracy and spreading lies and how all truth comes from YouTube. And I was a bit taken aback by this because it wasn't a joke. And it's a little intimidating. Because you know how, like, even if you have not got anything illicit on you and you're totally entitled to be there, you know, customs is always a little bit of an unnerving experience.
Totally. Just because I always get incredibly nervous,
you get the impression that they can do anything they want to you and disappear you and no one will ever know. And so I kind of didn't say anything. I did make a little, I'm just here to write about Star Wars. And he's like, oh, fake news. And I was like, well, you know, we'd give Attack of the Clones 5 stars. That didn't go down well.
You actually said that?
Well, yeah, I don't think I said Attack of the Clones. I think I said we did give a Star Wars. I've made some reference to Chris's review because I realised that obviously you need a lot of background.
Thought, maybe this immigration guy might know about this famous comedic thing that happened in Empire that Chris gave.
That's an in-joke that with an us in-joke. And like 50 readers of
it's
Empire.
True. Yeah, it is true.
It might have spread.
But this was the thing. Like, so afterwards, I did what anyone would do. Instead of making a plane, I just got really passag about it on Twitter and just moaned about it. And then I just thought, well, that's it. You know what I mean? That's it. I rage on Twitter. And then, you know, I kept getting a few mentions. And then I got really abusive mentions. And then, long story short, I got like 70,000 likes from fascists and like 30,000 retweets. And I got a lot of abuse, so I had to turn off my Twitter mentions. And then loads of newspapers and stuff calling me for quotes, and it kind of spiraled out of control until I can't remember his job title, but I think it's the area director of operations or something for Customs and Border Patrol, which is part of Homeland Security, called me on my phone to formally apologise for the incident.
Where did he get your phone number from?
He got it because the PR person, like the publicist for CBP, contacted the Washington Post, and they passed his message on to me. And I emailed him and said, how can I help you? And he went, we would like to arrange a call with this important man. He said, would you be available? And I said to him, I mean, yeah, I've got to be in a panel about Frozen 2, unfortunately, at that time. But if you can wait until Frozen's finished, I will absolutely speak to you. So I did that.
In the film of this incident.
Who will play me?
In the epic, who's going to play you? Who's going to play the Border Patrol guy, the first guy who said you're part of fake news?
Russell Crowe.
Really?
Yeah. An angry Russell Crowe.
Okay, we'll get to him later.
Yeah.
And the PR got, did you speak to the publicist?
Yes.
Are publicists for the border control, are they the same as the kind of publicists we'll deal with for TV and films? Or are they like a different kind of publicist where they, do you sound basically the same as they do?
I mean, a little bit. It was like, patching you through, it was a bit, it wasn't dissimilar to doing an interview. It was fine, He was very nice. He was very polite. And honestly, despite the whole thing, and I've talked about this a lot on Twitter, so I won't repeat it all here, but I found the whole thing very demoralising, that the fact that this fake news narrative is now so widespread that people just speak it as fact in official capacities, which I have since learned is a violation of the Hatch Act, which forbids federal employees from having political bias. But
it is an incredible... I mean, loads of things come to mind, but it does bring home the incredible success of that phrase, fake news, as propagated by Donald Trump and his acolytes.
Which is quite terrifying.
It's unbelievable, isn't it? I mean, it is extraordinary. And I think it happens here a lot. I see a lot. But the brilliant thing for me was, for you experiencing it, it sounds like a nightmare, and I would have been, having a nervous breakdown about it. But I think you dealt with it brilliantly. But the dream scenario for me is that you had all these psychopathic right-wing nuts linking it to that, didn't happen.com or whatever the fuck it is, and saying you're lying. And I think you're congenitally incapable of lying anyway. You just have the weird kind of non-lying personality
it's
going
pathologically
on.
Pathologically honest.
It's called having no filter. Yeah.
So I knew you weren't. I knew, of course, everything you said had happened. But to actually get confirmation from the head of the immigration people that it had happened, who are not, they're not like liberal, lefty liberal twats. And then just to prove to these fucking morons that it did happen. What a beautiful moment of kind of natural justice. I thought that was so good.
There was a natural escalation to that because they were like, I'll take shit that didn't happen for $100.
Yeah, right.
And I went, oh, well, if you look at the Newsweek article, they spoke to CBP and they've confirmed it happened. They went, that's fake news. I said, well, the guy literally just called me on my phone and apologised. I don't know what to say. That's a lie. Oh, I don't really know how to help you then.
But, absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, so this is all going to be really fun when I go back to America next week and we see what happens.
I think you're going to get carried through on somebody's shoulders.
Yes. Same. I suspect. I think you're going to be ushered through. I think you're a VIP
now. It could go one of two very different ways. So I guess we'll find out what happens. I wonder if this podcast that we're just recording will be used in evidence against me.
Sorry, yeah.
We'll see what happens as a kind of provocateur and member of the resistance, as I now am.
Oh, God, don't get carried away.
I did get like 5,500 Twitter followers in 24 hours, which was quite nice.
Oh, so, James.
I quite enjoyed that. Hey, look, that's how I measure my self-worth, Terry White.
Also, what are you going to do when they stick around and work out all you do is talk shite about Virus Game?
I mean, genuinely, this is something that worried me. Because I stopped tweeting for a couple of days because I thought, I've got these new followers. The second I open my mouth, I'm going to lose all of them. Because all I do is talk about Star Wars and Thanos.
Yeah.
You know, and they obviously think I'm some political, you know, infighter. No. Yeah.
You did brilliantly link to the Pilot TV podcast.
I know.
That was so tacky.
Yeah. No, that was great.
Oh, my God.
I got so much shit for that on there as well. Because people thought I was making it up just for that. Because it got down to the bottom of the thing. I went, while you're here, please subscribe to the Pilot TV podcast.
Yeah, I saw one guy like, oh, he just made this up to promote his shit podcast. I was like, don't drag us into this. Very fine podcast.
I have besmirched all of your good name by associating you with me. Oh, good times. Well, that slight digression aside,
yes.
I had time to watch a lot of things
good.
During my time in solitary confinement. And let me tell you what I watched. So on the way out there, I binged a whole of Mindhunter,
right.
Which I loved lots.
Yeah, fantastic.
I have picked up Years and Years Again and immediately stopped it because I really enjoyed it, but obviously it depressed the hell out of me. And then I had the customs thing. And to come straight from watching Years and Years and then go through that made it all a bit too real for me.
Yeah, so your customs thing is very Years and Years.
Yeah, so I've kind of put that on hold a little bit now. I'm up to, I've got the fourth episode now, Peaky Blinders. I will say, without any spoilers, the scene at the beginning of the third episode, which involves nuns, is one of the greatest Peaky Blinders moments
ever. Oh, wow, I haven't seen that yet.
Third episode, there's like a prologue that involves nuns. I was like, that was magnificent.
That would, if episode three,
yeah.
That would have gone out yesterday when this comes out on Monday then, so people would have seen
excellent.
That.
Well, that thing that you all saw yesterday, where Tommy and Polly go to the convent, like that was mental. And I will say Helen McCrory's final line in that was just beautiful.
Wow.
Just, yeah, listen for my footsteps. Love it. And the last thing I was watching is Unforgotten. So while on the plane on the way back, I watched the whole of series two of Unforgotten, and now I am halfway through series three of Unforgotten. And I'd watched series one of this like a year ago and thought it was amazing. And I don't know, for some reason, never watched the other two. Mm. It is so good.
Absolutely brilliant.
And series ITV's, two in particular.
ITV's cold case crime drama. Yeah, it's brilliant. Yeah.
Just,
Nicola Walker and Sanjeev Bhaskar.
They're both amazing in it. But series two, which deals with, well, I won't say what it deals with, but like the subject matter of that is quite full on. And the way it resolves is really unexpected as well.
Yeah.
And I was just like, this is incredibly high quality television that not a lot of people watch.
That is brilliant. I love it.
So, you know, not worthy of a banshee because it's still on, but everyone should watch it.
Have you seen series three?
I'm watching it at the moment, halfway through.
Series three, the ending of that is extraordinary.
Well, I mean, I'm enjoying it. They're doing more, right?
Yeah.
Because it's
always been filmed.
Genuinely brilliant.
Yeah.
So I can't recommend Unforgettable. You'd love it, Terry. If you
I thought you were talking about Unforgettable, the police procedural drama with Poppy Montgomery.
No.
It's confusing because there's Unforgotten the movie, Unforgettable.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I'd also like to say you should watch Unforgettable. You would hate it, but everybody else should watch Unforgettable.
Okay, but you should watch Unforgotten because you genuinely would like it. It's quite miserable. People die.
I love her.
Yeah, Nicole's brilliant.
She's great.
She's really, really good in that. So that's what I've been watching. What have you guys been watching?
Well, so I think I'm only saying this to incur your wrath, but fuck it. I watched for the first time ever this week Great British Bake Off, which I have never seen in my life. And I missed the first season, was like, I can't get into this now. And I was living in New York at the time, and everyone on my British Twitter were like being mental about it. And I was just like, this is not for me. I accidentally watched the first episode this week of the new series. It's amazing.
Yeah.
No.
Yes.
It's so magical.
No. Yes.
There's so much great TV out there.
Yes.
I cannot get excited about someone making a meringue in a tent.
No, Terry's right. I've watched every single episode of Bake Off history.
But do you know what it does? I'll tell you what it does for me, especially in this week of all weeks, with the country going even more to shit than it previously had, is it reminds me of what is can be great about this country, and when and like the best of British people, and maybe in some ways it's kind of this anachronistic kind of throwbacky sort of halcyon days thing about it, I don't know, but like they're just also normal and lovely, and there's always a weird one, and there's and all the little types, and they're all just like desperate to impress Prue and be the best baker and make a really great Victoria sponge cake, and it's just beautiful and magical, and James has died.
I completely stopped listening while you were talking about sponge cakes.
It started out on BBC Two on like a Monday or something at 8:30. No one paid any attention to it, and then it became the biggest show on British TV. No. 13 million people watched it when it was on BBC One before Channel 4 bought it. It was the biggest thing on TV. I was asked to be in the first celebrity series.
Oh my God, right?
But and you said no.
Bearing in mind that because I was away. It was a long weekend. You had to be available for 3 full days, and I'd already booked a trip to New York. But anyway. It was so obscure in the first series that they had a celebrity special after the first series or so, and they asked people like me to take part in it. Like now, it's like, you know, fucking proper A-list stars do the celebrity version for it because it's become a complete proper phenomenon, and it is brilliant.
Yeah, I don't get it. Like Chris Hewitt, who you will have heard doing impressions of, among other things, me last week, is obsessed with all cooking reality. So Chris only watches, well, that's not true. He watches a few things, but he mainly watches reality TV, anything food-based. MasterChef The Rivals, Great British Bake Off, I can't think of any others, but I'm sure there are others.
There are loads.
What are they called? Name another one. A food show.
There's one right now about the chef's table, whatever.
He loves it. And he bangs on about Bake Off and whatnot. And
Do you know what? It's what everyone's talking at the moment about. The reason we're all kind of going and binge watching things like Friends and all of these things which actually make us feel safe and comfortable in this world, which is, you know, a total bin fire. I think that's what Bake Off does. I think there's something reassuring and comforting. It makes you think of your nana's baking. It makes you think of sunshine. It makes you think of trees. There's like a fucking tent in a field. It's like all the amazing things in life.
Isn't it just like Paul Hollywood being shitty about the consistency of marzipan?
I mean, he's a low point for me. He's a low point for me.
And the Mary Berry person isn't in anymore, is she?
It's Prue Leith now. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. She's amazing.
And Melon Sue hosted it. I mean, you know, I slightly prefer them, if I'm honest, to the current duo, but still.
Because it sold out and moved, and that was a whole thing.
Yeah, Channel 4. Mm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Channel 4 bought it for a huge amount.
I know the background. I know the mythology.
Which you're more aware of it than most things, most elements of popular culture. Yeah. But it's still, you're absolutely right, it's still a blissfully lovely little.
I needed it this
vacation
week.
Vacation away from the misery of proroguing.
I needed it this week.
Yeah.
I just, honestly, there's only so invested I can get in gattos. That's all I'm saying. They don't make gattos. I'm sure they do. I'm sure they do. Windmills out of gattos.
They're fucking incredible. The creations are incredible. Yeah, the showstoppers. I mean, come on.
It strikes me as strange, Terry, that you enjoy this. Like, I would have thought you'd prefer it more if it was like three different people each heating a pot noodle to a certain consistency. And you were like, no, the temperature on that one is 2 degrees suboptimal. I think you're fine. You didn't add the soy sauce at the correct time.
I'm not you, but my tastes are diametrically opposed. I either like pure and innocent and Downton and Great British Bake Off and things that make me feel safe and comfortable and warm, or I just want to watch Scum Misery and Cares over and over again.
Well, after that, now is the time where we would usually...
Hang on, what's Boyd been watching?
Yeah, thanks, mate.
Oh, was that not part of it? Yeah. I also watched Bake Off, by the way.
Do you two not just share a point these days? I get a point for myself. You two just get to share one.
He's back.
Boyd, what have you been watching?
Well, James, you'll approve of mine because it is a fictional created drama on Netflix. Elite is back, which is one of my favourite perverse teen dramas. It's Spanish. Mm. So it's like Spain's equivalent of 13 Reasons Why and Euphoria meets Big Little Lies and Skins. The first series was really kind of funny, and it's beautifully made, and it's kind of got big class conflicts. It's all about this incredibly posh public school in this village near, I think, Barcelona. And in the first series, some working class people ended up there because their school had been destroyed in some kind of natural disaster. So it's all about what happens when working class kids arrive in this super posh school and they all start having sex with each other and killing each other, literally. Yep. Season 2, now one of the characters has got disappeared, and that's the kind of ongoing mystery which they flash forward to. Meanwhile, all the new kids are also arriving and having sex with each other and killing each other. It is unbelievably fast-moving and pacey and exciting. It is brilliantly made, and it has some unbelievably extraordinary sex scenes and scenes of an adult nature and violence. And it's really like on point for there's like an Instagram storyline that's quite clever in episode two. And it's just, if you want a kind of really good, quite escapist load of old nonsense about teenagers being out of control, set in Spain, this is the one for you.
I do like a load of old nonsense.
Yeah.
Okay.
Elite.
Good.
Elite.
Well, all I was saying before your elite interlude is that now normally the time where you kind of pit my black withered soul against the best that comedy has to offer. Only, and this is you, Boyd, a challenge was issued a couple of weeks ago. That's right, that's right. You suggested that maybe, just maybe, Funny or Dire was less funny and more dire. I did, of course, what any benevolent and in no way narcissistic podcast host would do. I put the matter to a referendum. What's the worst thing could happen? Anyway, so the results of our particular people's vote are in. And would you like to know how it went?
I've been on Twitter and seen, but sure, why didn't you tell
us? Fine, well, that's taken some of the drama out of this, but we asked the question as to whether or not we should keep Funny or Dire, and 73% of respondents said, keep it!
Which I'm taking
as a moral victory. However, that's 27% of people who clearly find it incredibly tiresome, and that's actually quite a lot. So, in contrast to... maths. I think at the very least we are going to put this segment on an extended hiatus and maybe tweak it slightly so it's less all about me if we bring it back.
I did see a few comments saying, in a very kind of measured way, we like it, James, but maybe there could be something that Terry and Boyd could chip into.
There were a few. Again. Your fan base, your solid fan base.
The Dyerites. The Diehards, as someone said on Twitter.
I think we just call them the Dyer.
Yes. Or the base.
Yeah,
really. Referring to Donald Trump's base. You've got the base out in that vote.
I called on the base. The base liked it. Everyone else didn't like it. So. No, I know, I get it. Look, hang on. This is you came up with this segment, Boyd, and I will continue to come back to this. It's had nothing to do with me. But it's gone. It's done. We will think of something similar-y at some point.
Are you just killing it to get attention on Twitter?
Of course. Attention on Twitter.
So that when this then goes out and all of your base come out and go, no, James,
bring it back. No, I want when we do our live podcast on the 13th of September, see what I did there, slip in a plug for that. I want people to be shouting, funny or dire, and sort of like see if I can rally them to resurrect it.
Oh my God, it's become a rally for you.
Yeah, that's it.
Blimey.
Anyway, so that's not happening. So all I can say, sorry, Father Ted, you never got your chance. But I think we can all agree, I probably would have found you unamusing. Anyway, I would say, instead of that, we should go on to news. Except we can't, as you've both ruined news. Because you did the podcast this week on Tuesday morning, which means basically nothing has happened
between
then and now.
Oh, this is classic James, isn't it? He's decided there's no news.
Yes.
Because you couldn't find anyone, or you forgot to have a look.
I mean, no, I did. I looked yesterday and couldn't see anything interesting.
I'm going to give you this bit of news that I'm genuinely absolutely thrilled and excited about, which is that Phoebe Waller-Bridge is going to host an episode of Saturday Night Live coming up. And not only that, but she's going to have Taylor Swift as the musical guest. So basically, on October the 5th, you're going to get a sketch or sketches featuring Phoebe Waller-Bridge and Taylor Swift on Saturday Night Live.
That's good.
That will happen.
I don't like Saturday
exciting.
Night Live. But that does sound exciting.
Saturday Night Live, I mean, that's another thing. You're pretending you don't know about that now.
No, I know about it. I don't like it.
Why don't you like it?
I do not enjoy sketch shows. I do not enjoy variety shows. I do not enjoy entertainment shows. I do not enjoy anything that normally has someone addressing an audience.
So you watched that whole... What was that series that your hero did about... Which was basically about creating a show like Saturday Night Live.
That's fine, because it's a dramatised version of it. Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip.
A dramatised version of it.
Hang on. Are we got to this point now where our argument is just repeating what I've said in a slightly posh voice?
In your accent.
Great.
It's Saturday Night Live. I mean, it can be highly variable.
I'm not saying it's bad.
But
I just don't enjoy it.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
It's fine.
All right.
It's just fine. I don't find it. It's like sketch shows. Well, I just can't get involved in something that's so short. I just can't be dealing with that. So, okay, fine. Well, I have a piece of news, and it's not news, so it shouldn't be in news, but I'm going to treat it as news, and that is because this
that
news...
That sentence alone was incredible.
This news broke about 2 weeks ago, and I didn't do it on the podcast. For reasons unknown, I completely missed it, and several people said to me on Twitter, I cannot believe you didn't talk about the fact that Amazon announced loads of the casting for the Wheel of Time TV series.
Oh, Christ.
And I missed it. I mean, Who doesn't want to know that Josh Ostrodowski will play Randall Thor, a.k.a. the Dragon Reborn, He Who Comes With the Dawn, the Coromor, Shadow Killer? You know, to list some of his titles.
What do any of those words even mean?
Yeah, those character names are a bit disappointing. They're not like the Dune ones. tell us some Dune character
fine.
Names.
No, they're fine. So Marcus Rutherford is in this as Perrin A. Burra, the blacksmith.
Oh, I take it back.
Barney Harris as Matrim Cawthon. Zoe Robbins plays Nynaeve Almira, who's always playing with her hair. And, and Madeline Madden is playing Egwene Alvear. Oh. But more importantly, Rosamund Pike is in one of the major roles as Moiraine Damodred of the Aes Sedai. So
you've brought him back. You have won.
Of course, being a member of the Aes Sedai, I mean that she has the power to tap into Sidar, the female half of the true source.
I think our live podcast on the 13th of December at 9:30, King's Place, blah, 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 should just be you reading out character names from these stupid programmes like Dune and this one.
This was for you specifically, Boyd, because I remember you said last week when I wasn't here, you would love to hear me reading out the character names from,
well, can't get enough
from
of
which
it.
One was it? Was it from Carnival Row or Dark Crystal? I forget.
Carnival Row.
Anyway.
Both.
So there you go. That's me.
Can I just say you are going to the United States next week, and if immigration would like permission to actually detain James Dyer this time, then you have my express permission to make that happen.
Thanks, Terry. That's nice. Any other news? Terry, you must have some news.
It's not that exciting.
Oh.
But I agree with you. It's been an arid week for news.
An arid day and a half since you did the last one.
An arid week for news. There was this video released about filmmaker mode.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we talked about this on Empire as well.
Which is a new industry standard TV setting which essentially aims to show and display the movies how they were intended to be seen. So there's this video released this week which starred Martin Scorsese, Nolan, Christopher Nolan, that is, James Cameron, Ava DuVernay, Ang Lee, J.J. Abrams, Ryan Coogler, Christopher McQuarrie. And it's, in terms of what it actually does, and it doesn't surprise anybody, I don't think, that Nolan's really spearheading
Nolan, who won't even shoot on digital, yes.
I'm surprised he even acknowledged television exists.
Television?
But,
what is this fairy-powered magic box?
But essentially, it will disable motion smoothing and preserve the aspect ratio, colour balance, and the frame rate of a movie. And they said it'll be successful on TVs for multiple manufacturers. It doesn't really say when or which, or can you upgrade what you've got at home already. But I thought it was interesting that he got so many filmmakers on board and so many diverse filmmakers from different kind of perspectives, because I think nobody's surprised. Cameron and Nolan have spoken extensively really about this in the past. McQuarrie has. Him and Tom Cruise had a similar thing last year, right, where they were talking about settings.
Specifically
on,
motion smoothing.
They've done motion smoothing. But actually to see people like Ava and Ryan Coogler and it kind of being more of an industry-wide thing...
Perceptible
to the average viewer it will be. I don't know. What do you think?
The difference between motion smoothing and non-motion smoothing is pretty obvious.
Yeah.
But then some people say they can't tell the difference between HD and SD, so I guess your mileage may vary. It depends on how big your screen is.
Your
on Boyd's TV, you absolutely will notice.
Hang on, your mileage may vary.
Have you never heard this phrase before?
Your
mileage may vary. This is a fairly common...
Yeah.
I'm not a car.
Wow. Okay. So clearly that idiom was lost on Terry. But yes, I think I do think people will probably notice. So I bored everyone's tits off about frame rates about this on the Empire podcast on Friday. So I'm not going to go into it's 24 frames a second for a motion picture. And it's because that's all quite tedious.
The thing for me, though, someone pointed out on Twitter, I can't remember who it was, that it's slightly pointless because what they're not doing, as far as I can make out about the whole announcement, is that's not going to be the default setting.
No, you need to turn it on.
If it was, then hooray,
yeah.
So consumers, TV watchers, are still going to have to find the bit in their system where they can change the settings.
Yes.
You're a bell end.
Nerdy bell ends do it. But that's the whole point. Normal consumers do not do that.
Boyd, if you have motion smoothing turned on your enormous 70-inch TV, you should be fired.
Of course I don't. But because I know where the fucking... Because I've already got a cinema mode on my Samsung 78-inch, which does exactly what Christopher Nolan's talking about. But... It should be the default setting. That's what's going to change.
The issue is, like, motion smoothing as an existing thing is not the problem. The problem is most TVs have it on by default.
Yeah.
That's the problem. People don't know how to disable it.
Exactly.
So, yeah, I'm not sure how this helps that particular fact, but maybe as part of this, motion smoothing will never be on by default. It will be a thing of the past.
Why is it on?
Because I think TV
because,
people...
I'll tell you why.
Isn't
because,
it is it sport? Do they like it for
it's
sport?
Partly sport, but normal TV... So, in fact, actually, of course, this is now becoming slightly obsolete because, you know, stuff shot on by Netflix and HBO, you know, general drama now is shot in such a cinematic way that actually that stuff looks like cinematic and looks like film too anyway. But, you know, your kind of... Your studio shows and your and sport looks much more vibrant and vivid. The colours are incredibly vibrant and vivid with the normal setting. That's what the setting is of a TV. It's all about, you know, general normal viewing of TV in quotes. So and motion smoothing helps with football, I guess, and it does help with it, just makes it all seem shinier and glossier, and it's and people the, I think the general sense is that people like their TV, normal TV, to look like that. But I think over time it'll
fundamentally
it'll
the refresh rate of a TV screen is higher than the 24 frames you get on cinema. So stuff shot in 24 frames a second, like movie stuff, when the camera pans, it judders.
Yeah.
And we associate that with being cinematic. And so when that isn't there, like when it's smoothed in, because motion smoothing basically it creates artificial frames to pad out the gaps, and it makes it look weird and unnatural. And you get a smearing effect on someone as well. Like someone's like been spreading stuff all over the screen. It's horrible. So anyway, that's filmmaker
mode.
All
I heard was
good.
Football and the patriarchy, so you know.
Of course you did. Of course, that's all you ever hear, Terry. Right, on that note, it is time for this week's guests. Orlando Bloom and Cara Delevingne stopped by for a chat about fairies and their show, Carnival Row. And our Jason Arnop went and spoke to them about it. And this is what happened.
Cara Delevingne and Orlando Bloom, welcome to the Pilot TV podcast.
Oh, hey. Thank you for having us.
Hi. So your new series, Carnival Row, which is available to watch as we speak on Prime Video, is this lovely, wonderfully bewitching brew of stuff, isn't it? Different elements, you know, there's a love
bewitching
story.
Bewitching brew, I like it, yes.
Bewitching brew.
Well said.
You've got a love story between your two characters burning away at the centre of it. You've got an inspector hunting down a hammer-wielding killer. Mm. And then on top of all of that, you've got these very strong real-world parallels with mythical creatures seeking refuge in this kind of neo-Victorian version of London. So if all of those elements and potentially more, obviously, which were your favourites, in a sense? What did you feel most strongly about, and which of those elements drew you most to Carnival Row?
Can I just say that was so beautifully concise. I wish I could have given it.
You may
I wish
say
I could
that.
Have had this interview.
Just remember it
ago
and repeat
we were
it.
I'm like, wait, the parallels. That, that was amazing. I think initially I read it for the first time and I thought, I haven't seen a world like this, and I've done a little bit of fantasy and this is definitely new and different. And I thought, I loved the parallels and I loved the idea of the social commentary, the fact that it was written 20 years ago and there's a reference to, you know, the world that we live in today, the migrant refugee crisis. As an actor, when art mirrors life a little, it's fantastic. And then the character of Philo was somebody who I thought I could really get my teeth stuck into. And if I was going to do an 8-hour movie, which is basically what this is, and felt like when we were making it, and with the potential of maybe doing another 8-hour movie, which we are doing for the second season, which is great. I wanted to be sure that there'd be a character that I could really kind of get under the skin of. And Philo was sort of definitely that. Felt like an interesting man that I could go on a journey with, for sure.
Absolutely. What about you, Carl?
I just think how vast the world is, considering like reading something like that when it hasn't come from anywhere else but from a man who wrote it 20 years ago in his dorm room is one of the most insane things in the world. And whether or not I did the project or not, I wanted to meet him to just say, wow, well done. Can I live in your head for 2 days? Like, seriously, it was brilliant. And then, I was just completely enamored and fascinated by Vignette as a character, and just couldn't really... You know, and I've dealt with rejection a lot on not getting parts I've completely adored, but I just was fascinated by her. And even if I hadn't have got the role, I would have still thought about her to this day. You know, there's something that sparked something in me. Mm. And then again, the commentary on, especially I think the way of unnecessary fear and how people can't really hate each other if they really understood each other and if they really took time to learn from each other instead of just learning and trying to take land, have power, and control. And it's all about, you know, and then also using fear to control people and how then people have to fear each other when there's no reason to.
Nothing like the world we live in today.
Nothing.
No, no. No, I know. It's unfortunate.
People in power using fear to control people. Yeah, it's weird. Yeah. It's so strange.
It's unfortunate that, you know, that commentary feels like a mirror as opposed to an exaggeration, isn't it? Yeah.
Literal mirror, yeah.
So the characters really drew you in. That was one of the things that you liked. So let's talk a little bit more about the characters. Let's talk about Vignette Stone Moss, which is one of the best names ever for a
ever.
Start. How cool is that name? Great names in this show.
But that's also Travis, like, he came up with such good names. Mm. Like, you know, people try and find baby names for so long and, like, weird. He's thought of these incredible. I mean, I always like one of those very exaggerated, love an exaggerated name, but these names are.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
There may be a few more vignettes in the world after this series
maybe.
Goes out.
Oh.
Yeah. Who knows?
Yeah,
so she's kind of Vignette is kind of hardened by hurt, isn't she, really?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what else would you say about her?
She's hardened by hurt for sure. I mean, she's definitely had to learn how to, I'd say as a, like, if she's learned how to hiss, you know? If people try and bite her, I think she starts to hiss, which is something that I don't think she ever had to do. Mm. But she had to learn to protect herself and learn how to survive, and I think you can't help but get hardened by that. But her outer skin got hardened, but her heart didn't, you know?
Yeah.
Her heart never changed. I mean, look, she was grieving someone for 7 years still, very much to the day. So, like, her heart definitely never changed, which is something I really respect about her. Because I think some ways, if her heart had hardened, she might as well not be alive, because I think her heart is the thing that kept her going, you know?
Yes, and obviously this terrible man we're talking about is your character, Inspector Philo. Mm. What would you say about him? He's a hard
man to get
to know.
He's not so bad. He's so bad.
Yeah. Oh, everything is so nuanced. You know, Philo was born an orphan, raised in an orphanage, did military service, and then ended up being a detective in the Burgish police force. Mm. And I just, you know, when you think about what that does to a psyche and being institutionalized from birth and the lack of love, the lack of the fear around intimacy, the fear that would come from all of those experiences, the risks and edges that he would take, you know, the danger that he would put himself in for. And I loved getting under that skin and then thinking about, he has this secret which is revealed as the show goes along, and to me, I felt like that was probably his superpower. And if there is, and that would be empathy, you know, as a man who can sort of empathize with the plight of the Fae. And I thought that was something that I really started to gun for as a theme for him throughout the show, and somebody who, you know. Weirdly, in the world today, if there is something sort of heroic about Philo, it's that he's just trying to do the right thing, you know. And actually, I thought, wow, in the world we live in today, just doing the right thing makes you a hero. Do you know what I mean? Because actually, I think there are so many people, and we're so easily led astray. It's so easy to not, you know, or to avoid. And Philo's like, he's on the front line doing the right thing as much and as often as he can.
Yeah.
There's sometimes an earnestness to that. There's sometimes, but not really. I think it's more just of a, he has a need to fulfill, and that's to make good on, to make good on a promise to himself. So
yeah. So speaking of doing the right thing, if you know, several of the characters in the show have wings, if either of you had wings, to what extent would you use that power only for good?
I would rescue people from places that they couldn't be rescued from.
Ooh, like
with wings.
Kittens from trees and stuff.
People. Anyone can get down kittens from trees. Also, kittens can jump down from trees. Man. Kittens jump in trees so they can go, screw you humans, they can't get me out, huh? That's what I think, because cats are clever. That's fine.
I would rescue kittens from trees.
All right. So between you, you've got creatures.
We've got the kittens and the humans covered. Listen, what more do you want?
Absolutely fantastic. Well, that's great to hear, the altruism there.
I mean, if you have wings, though, can you also have, like, super amp powers where you can live 10 times your weight? Because then I would just pick up the whole ocean and put it on the Amazon. Right?
Amp powers.
Maybe we'll find out in season two, listeners.
Season two.
Well, thank you so much for speaking to us.
Thank you so much.
That was Cara Delevingne and Orlando Bloom. Time now for this week's reviews. First up this week,
is The Capture. This is a new BBC drama which stars Holiday Grainger, Callum Turner, Laura Haddock, and apparently Ron Perlman, although he wasn't in the first episode. Turner plays a British soldier accused of a crime on the basis of CCTV footage, with Grainger as the high-flying police inspector charged with heading up the case. The crime was caught on video, so it's a slam dunk. Or is it? Boy, did this capture your attention?
I like your little dramatic little intro there. That was great.
Thank you.
Yeah, I really like it. Yeah, I should say that I hosted the screening for this, the launch of it, and interviewed said stars.
So what you're saying is you are now completely biased.
Well, I think you have to...
How much did they pay you, Boyd?
Yeah, Boyd. They paid me, yes.
How much did they pay you, Boyd?
I've been paid.
Fake news! Get out!
Fake news, Boyd!
I'm being transparent. I've been paid good money to... sit there and
promote this for the show.
Good money. He's been paid good money.
I've been paid good money to sit there asking the creators good questions about this show. And now I'm giving my unbiased, objective review.
Let's hear it.
I really like it.
Go on.
Yeah, I think it's...
You shocked me.
I wish I had some pound coins to throw at you.
I'm really glad you don't. I think it's a really interesting premise. I think it's taking something that's happening, is going to be more and more an important element of technology going forward, which is that you really can create video footage of people saying stuff they did not say in situations they were not in, and you can completely fictionalize, you can completely invent your own news, effectively.
Like fake news.
Like fake news, but visual. Actual visual fakeness, which I think is even more of a kind of a worry than just, you know, people lying about
James.
Yeah. to fascists on Twitter.
Yeah.
So it uses that in a really interesting way, and I think it's got a kind of propulsive storytelling technique. I think it's fast moving. I think the cast is great. I love Holiday Grainger. I thought she was great in Strike, the Corman Strike adaptations, and here she's centre stage. There's some good entanglement going on because she's involved with someone who's tangentially involved and maybe more in the investigation, and the guy is essentially investigation involved with other people, so it's a very well kind of put together plot, I think, and I'm most of all it's just really compelling and gripping, and I really want to know what happens next.
Despite the fact that you were clearly paid for that bit of fake news, I'm pretty much in agreement with you. I really enjoyed this. I've only seen the first one. I cannot wait to watch the second one. I like this whole sort of 1984-y, as in, you know, the book, not the era,
yeah.
Feel about this. This sort of... And I like the cold open. There's a cold open when you see the kind of... these sort of public servants in their little room monitoring the CCTV footage, and you see her kind of look of horror as whatever is transpires on the screen. And it's an interesting idea about what happens when CCTV culture and surveillance culture, of which we are a part, overlaps with the deep fake culture, which is the idea that you literally can create video, convincing video, of anyone doing anything.
Yeah,
so
that's what I was trying to say.
Those two things coexisting is an incredibly troubling time for us at the moment. And you can well imagine that in the next presidential election, you know, it wouldn't shock me to see footage of one of the nominees going and doing something horrific, and it turns out that someone's just knocked it up using the deepfake algorithm.
Well, there was that press conference footage, do you remember, where a reporter... and an intern was sent over to try and grab the mic off him when he was questioning Trump. And it was edited and put out by his official PR person, and it had been edited to show that he was kind of touching her in some way when she went to grab the microphone.
Yeah.
And it was astonishing that had been edited in such a way to misrepresent what happened, and by the White House.
Yeah, I know, they put it out officially. Yeah. Who's fake news
and
now?
And Holiday Grainger in Pilot TV magazine last issue, Pilot, mentioned that incident and that moment as the thing that really crystallised in her mind the possibilities of this whole concept.
That was Jim Acosta, wasn't it?
Yes, it was Jim Acosta. And he had his credentials.
He did have his credentials. Yeah. And they had doctored this footage to show him doing something that he hadn't done. And that's a relatively minor thing. Have you seen the thing? I think is it Bill Hader on... It was one of the talk shows, Conan, Letterman, one of those. And they turn him into Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah. And Tom Cruise.
Yeah. And Tom Cruise using deepfake technology. And it's terrifying.
Mm.
And this is just done by what's available on the internet. So you can imagine what, you know, serious outfits, you know, dedicated to doing this could accomplish.
The thing is, from a philosophical perspective, I find this really interesting. But from a straight TV drama perspective, and I must say I really enjoyed this as well. Like, I finished the first episode and I was gutted. I didn't have time to watch the second before this podcast. I was like, I really need to write a review, but I really, really want to watch the second episode of this program. Is because, you know, there's no doubt from the first episode that he's not done what he's been accused of and that this has been... I don't think so when you get to the end.
I think there might be. I think there's room
could
for
be
a
more
twist.
To it.
Well, there may be a twist, but the setup very much is the audience. Yeah. You're meant to believe that this was in some way faked in it. So maybe Boyd is hinting at the fact that that's misleading.
I don't know at all. But
because kind of ruined it for me in some respects, in that I kind of enjoyed it when you weren't sure if it was him or it wasn't him. And we don't want to give away what's in the CCTV footage because that's a really important part of the episode unfolding. But it puts you on a very specific road in terms of, it's not kind of up for debate whether he did do that. You're pretty convinced as the audience that he didn't do that. And this is, as you say, about these conspiring forces who've gone out of their way to make it look like he had. I have to say, Holiday Grainger is amazing. She's dealing with, I have to say, a lot of tropes in there, right? So she's they call her a fast track princess at one point.
Yeah.
She's having an affair with her married ex-boss. She's like clearly somebody who prizes her career over everything else, including her personal life. She's desperately ambitious, young and attractive, and there's all these kind of things. And at first I was a little bit, but she's super compelling. Mm-hmm. She's really fantastic. I thought they were all fantastic. I thought Callum Turner, actually.
The interrogation scene when he is accused, his response, I thought, was incredible.
Yeah. And I think they both are incredible and really both carry this along. Mm. And I agree with you, the propulsive nature of it wasn't kind of frenetic or anything, but you were just kind of compelled from the first minute. The rhythm of it was fantastic.
And it's all written and directed by this one guy, Ben Channel, which is quite unusual, I think, in British TV.
And is this a mini series as opposed to a series?
Yeah, it's a six part self-contained. I mean, I think, you know, I get the sense that I think, they will definitely be resolved. They were very firm. I haven't watched the whole
thing. But they might come back with another.
But you can imagine how she could come back.
Indeed.
You know, but all I'd say about your point about he definitely hasn't, you know, what we think about his character, what I think there's room for, and I've not seen it, but I think there's room for the idea that he is a wrong'un and maybe in other ways, and that he might, you know what I mean? So I think there's still a lot of tension regarding what he's actually really all about. I think that is what's going to be.
Because obviously it begins with him on trial for something else, which is, again, connected to manipulation of footage. So
which is presumably not a coincidence.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And by the way, that fact that the way he gets off of that, which is right at the beginning,
Oh, I know, because we've experienced it in the stuff, the equipment we use, that you get drift when the audio gets out of sync from the video.
Audio drift.
Yeah, audio drift. Right, well, that is The Capture, and this airs on BBC One on Tuesday, September the 3rd at 9 p.m. Next up is A Confession, an ITV drama that stars Martin Freeman as real-life copper DSU Steve Fulcher, who adopted some, shall we say, unorthodox policing tactics back in 2011 when he arrested the chief suspect in a woman's disappearance in an Asda car park and had him taken to an Iron Age fort outside Swindon for interrogation, as you do. Terry, this is reasonably bleak and quite nihilistic. You must have loved it.
Not so much, I have to say. I had one big problem from the get-go, which was the incredibly distracting camera work. I don't know if you two noticed this, but there were these kind of... It was really wobbly and jerky, and there was some really weird super zooming going on, which but really crazy zooming, and I couldn't get my head around it because I couldn't work out what they were going for. It didn't look like normal Steadicam stuff at all. It was a very deliberate... I would presume it was a really deliberate choice on their part, whether it's meant to make it feel raw, and I don't know, but it totally threw me off. There's a scene at the beginning with Martin Freeman and with John Thompson in a cafe, and it was like so disorientating. Martin Freeman, who I think is a fantastic actor, he doesn't work for me in this role at all. So I found his kind of performance quite awkward and uncomfortable. I just didn't buy any of it whatsoever, I have to say. There are a couple of kind of quite heavy-handed things. So there's you meet this middle-aged loner who's a suspect who lives with his mum. he tells a story about driving to buy some Monster Munch. From then on in, he's known as Monster Munch Man. He's your kind of like classic crime drama, overweight, loner kind of. When he, there was a bit with his mum where I was just like, I've seen this a million times before in every single one of these dramas. I love crime dramas. I love Martin Freeman. I love Siobhan Finneran's in it, who plays the girl who goes missing, plays her mum, who I just think is fantastic. It just didn't work for me. All of this said, I got to the end of the first episode and I kind of really wanted to see the second episode. It isn't probably surprising to say there is a twist in the last third, which actually is probably the reason I want to keep watching it. Something about it makes me want to keep watching it, but I don't think it's anywhere near the quality of, for example, The Capture. I don't think it's at that level. It doesn't feel cinematic. It doesn't feel like it has proper scale and scope.
Very ITV.
And I hate to say that, and I really hate to say that, and I thought Boyd's going to launch himself at me across the desk, because Boyd rightly defends the kind of traditional TV channels that have been putting out solid stuff for years and have great moments as well. But this didn't feel like the best of ITV to me, and it didn't feel like it would be something that would ever air on the BBC, for example. And we're seeing so much amazing stuff in this genre as well. Crime dramas like this used to be kind of the fodder for, you know, that was Sunday nights, a certain audience, didn't have much money put into it. We're not in that world anymore. And so I feel like because of that shift, this feels to me old-fashioned and just not of the level we're used to seeing.
Boyd, have ITV paid you any money to spring to this show's defence?
No, I did not host the launch of this show. I think it's interesting because this is true crime. So
yes.
This is a very famous...
James said that already.
Yeah, it's a dramatisation of true crime.
I know, I'm just reminding people that this is a pretty famous example of true crime.
But that doesn't excuse anything.
Let me finish. All I'm saying, I wonder, because I agree with you to a large extent. I was surprised that the visual texture of it felt very traditional and old-fashioned, barring the weird Zoom thing, which I noticed as well. And I wondered partly whether that was trying to make it feel more documentary-like maybe or something.
It reminded me, do you know what it reminded me of? The Office, weirdly.
Yes, exactly.
So docudrama, kind of parodies, it reminded me of The Office massively.
But as Ricky Gervais says about The Office, they would do it differently now, because actually documentary making has gone on leaps and bounds. It is itself much more cinematic and kind of different to how it was back in the day. So this does feel weirdly basic in that sense. I absolutely agree. And I wonder whether, but why I mentioned the true crime thing, I wonder whether they almost feel hampered slightly because this is such a famous case, and that there's still a lot of people alive still, you know, and the main guy, the detective, is talking about it now, and, you know, this had a huge impact on his career. And I feel the same about Martin Freeman's performance. I actually liked his performance, but I felt everyone was slightly underplaying and trying to be quite tasteful and, you know, and real and keeping it real and not making it too kind of epic and cinematic, because it's this real thing that everyone knows about, a lot of people know about, a lot of people are still affected by it. And I'm not saying it was the right creative decision, because I don't necessarily think it is. So I feel it was hampered by that, And I thought everyone was like, the whole thing was being made slightly with their hands tied behind their back. But I really like Martin Freeman. I totally disagree about his performance, though. I thought he was very authentic. And I felt like what was refreshing about his performance was I felt like he was just this normal guy who happens to be a detective. And he reminded me of, like, if you watch 24 Hours in Police Custody, those things on Channel 4. Yes. He was like that, really. Like, not particularly interesting, unusual,
I felt like he was trying, they were all trying desperately to be normal, to your point. The underplaying it, being a normal guy.
Yeah.
This is how a normal guy would talk. There's a meeting they go into and there's, like, little bits you don't hear. And it felt very much like documentary, like you were just witnessing something that was happening in real life. I was so conscious that he was acting all the way through every time he underplayed it a little bit more, and it was like, I'm just this normal detective guy. I'm kind of, you know, you don't realise much about his personality. He doesn't have any strong character traits. The more I was really conscious that it was Martin Freeman acting.
I kind of went along with it pretty much. I went along with all the performances. I thought they're all kind of, you know, Imelda Staunton's in it. Mm-hmm. The dude from This Country's in it. You know,
Pete John from Cold Feet as a Robin.
Yeah, exactly. So
very briefly.
Yeah. So I thought the performances were the best thing about it for me, and I agree with you, even though I was sitting there going, oh, this is a, you know, It's not quite doing it for me in terms of the way it's being made and everything. By the end of it, I really want to carry on watching it.
I'm absolutely going to carry on watching it,
even though I know the whole fucking story, because it's all, you know, it is a famous true crime story. But actually, the detail of it, I am fascinated by. And I think that's what it's all about for the people who made it. Mm. For Jeff Pope, who's like the expert at writing these things, who wrote this, I think it's all about getting the detail right. And that I think it does it pretty well, but yeah.
No, I agree with you. It didn't feel particularly lavish to me. It felt, I must admit, the zooming thing didn't bother me quite as much. I didn't really worry too much about that. But I wasn't wildly compelled by this, by the way it's set up. Until, as you said, the last section when there is an allusion to a twist. Mm-hmm. But I was just like, this is fine. But again, you end up in the same mindset. Where, this is absolutely fine. And were there no other TV, I would absolutely watch this. However,
this is like your idea of hell. Let's be frank.
No, it's fine. Like I know. See, this is something I have a real weakness for, your old Brit police drama. Like I really like I used to, and at some
you're
point,
old.
I Will Banshee, DCI Banks, which I was obsessed with.
Oh, wow.
You know, and I love Unforgotten. Like there's something about like Brit police drama that can be really, really good. But perhaps it is, as Boyd says, the true crime nature of this. It affects the rhythm and the structure of the story because they can't, you know, take optimum dramatic routes. They have to report the facts.
What I was going to say was, funnily enough, I have just watched quite a lot of this new thing coming up on Netflix, which I'm sure we'll review in a couple of weeks' time, which is called Unbelievable, which is an even more sensitive true crime story, which is very, very famous in America. Mm. And I have to say, that is a kind of, in its way, is cinematic and brilliantly made, and also, and I felt, and I did keep thinking of that, thinking actually it can be done. You can do all of these things properly, and this didn't quite have what that has when we get round to it.
Yeah, because I think true crime has been adapted and dramatised before, and I understand the constraints that can place upon you, and you have to be really conscious, as you say, there are living people still involved in this. It's not, you know, we're not talking about something that was decades and decades and decades ago. It's quite fresh in people's memories. So you have to be authentic and true to what happened. But I think it shouldn't impact the filmmaking to that extent. I understand why that would affect story and plot lines. Mm. Of course, I get that. And writing to some extent, because you can't just fictionalise and invent huge portions of things. But I think when it comes down to filmmaking and kind of dramatic intent and all of that, I think that should still be there.
Mm. Yeah.
And can still be there.
Well, A Confession airs on Monday, September the 2nd at 9 p.m. on ITV. Also out this week is The Loudest Voice. This is a show about Russell Crowe in a fat suit. It's a drama that casts Crowe as Roger Ailes, the evil mastermind behind Fox News, and is subject of numerous sexual misconduct investigations. This aired in early August in the States, and it follows Ailes, as he's building the Republican cable news propaganda machine that now effectively programs the current US president. And all the shit that followed after that. Boyd, was this good for what ails you?
Oh, wow. What
Sorry, I really need to stop was, those puns because they're even upsetting me. But anyway, did you like it?
I don't like to, you know me, I don't like to get carried away generally, but I was fucking massively disappointed by this.
Thank God, I thought you were going to say the opposite.
I was going to say, did you love it? What's wrong with you?
What's happening?
To the point where it made me quite furious.
Good.
I think it's such a missed opportunity. It's so clunky and obvious. Where to begin? First of all, as you alluded to, the whole fat suit, the makeup is not convincing. First, I mean, if you've got to get past that initial fact that Russell Crowe is playing this guy who was a big, big, big guy, Roger Ailes, and they try and they give him a huge amount of latex, you know, stuff on his face. It doesn't look real, does it? There's something about either the way it's been shot and lit and everything, but
it's the prosthetic itself.
Because
it doesn't move. So
no,
when his
right.
face moves and when he talks, it doesn't move. Yeah. And it's so distracting, because all you can look at is the fact, and he moves really awkwardly because
terrible,
he's got a massive prosthetic on his
But
neck.
Then you've also got Rupert Murdoch, played by Simon Burnley, who's got his own Murdoch mask. Yeah. And he's got a similar thing. They've obsessively tried to get them looking like their real life counterparts, forgetting that it's totally off putting and it takes you completely out of the story anyway. But more importantly than that, I found the whole style and tone and storytelling incredibly old fashioned and almost to the point where it felt like it'd been made about 10 years ago, like when it set, or, you know, however long ago it was. So the first episode is the build up to the launching of Fox News. I could not be more interested in this stuff. This is my absolute... I'm obsessed with all this, you know, how the importance of Fox News has changed America and changed the world, and fucking Trump does literally... that's his whole life is watching this channel. And yet, and there's the whole Me Too element of it as well. And yet, it was quite boring. There were long, long scenes where Roger Ailes' character just stands there holding forth, explaining how brilliant he is, and just speechifying. And it brings the whole drama to a halt. And I just thought... And you know what? Halfway through, I thought, what is wrong with this whole thing? It's just not working anyway. And I thought, Succession, your favourite, which we've really covered, it needs to be like that. It needs to have the quickfire pace and immediacy of something like Succession or any of those Armando Iannucci things. If it had been done like that, or even like The Big Short and, you know, and Vice, that kind of texture to it. But it's all so staid and tedious and slow and stagey. It's really
fucking
terrible.
And the first episode is written and directed by Tom McCarthy,
who did
bloody Spotlight. Yeah. You know, so you don't expect that from it.
I could not believe how bad it is.
Yeah, I think it felt, and I don't want to say, because I know a lot of people's work done this, I'm not going to say it's lazy, but it felt like it didn't go below the skin. Do you know what I mean? It seemed a really sort of surface level account of what happened. And like, you know, right up to the point where when he's interviewing like a female anchor for the job, and the sexual harassment is so overt, like he's running his thumb over her lips and stuff. And so for all I know, that literally happened, but it just felt like a really... like really sort of first base, you know, stand up of this conservative boogeyman. And this is obviously what he was, but there was no subtlety to that depiction. And I was just rolling my eyes slightly. And he's just such an unrepentant twat all the way through this. And I enjoyed the scene, the boardroom scene, where he basically like thunders at everyone, screams and shouts. And they have that thing where he kind of vacillates between this sort of avuncular, you know, happy fat man thing to like insane screaming psychopath, but it's just not fun. And then Seth MacFarlane is just bumbling around in the background doing I'm not sure what, and I wasn't particularly drawn with it. And exactly as you say, like, I'm fascinated on paper by this piece of history and how it happened, but not fascinated by watching this account of how it happened.
No.
So it was really disappointing.
But you don't even believe his genius, because at the heart of it has always been this thing, which is he's a terrible human being. He did all these awful things, but he completely...
But he's
amazing. He made him and Murdoch, but primarily him with his vision, made Fox News happen. Yeah. And there's a scene where he has this, where it's essentially a eureka moment where he defines what Fox News is. It's so verse-based what he says, and you're never convinced that he is this great visionary, that he has this amazing media brain. You don't buy any of it whatsoever. I mean, to your point, James, that scene you're talking about with the girl.
Yeah.
I mean, he ends that scene by saying, "How do you get on with your dad?"
Yeah.
And
what the fuck?
There'd been a scene a few minutes earlier where he'd said to another woman, "I do enjoy you in a pearl necklace." I mean, you know, as you say, maybe it was on the nose, but when you're watching it, you're like, really? And there is no nuance. So you don't... It feels superficial and thin in a really surprising way. You're not convinced you know any more about him as a man, professionally, personally. You do see that kind of volatile character, and you understand kind of what that must be like to have been around. He's so domineering to his wife, Beth. Like, they paint that picture very well, but I didn't feel like I learned anything, like I understood any more about him. That I really kind of, they'd painted a true portrait of him and his flaws, as well as obviously what made him be able to build such a huge fucking network. And the prosthetics, there was a bit with Rupert Murdoch where he moved his neck in a meeting and there was this massive big bulge of prosthetic, and I was like, I don't understand. Like,
it's,
you know,
weird,
what? Fucking Christian Bale did Vice and put on a shitload of weight. Get fat, Russell Crowe. Get fat. Get dead fat. Because the prosthetic is so distracting.
Yeah, it is.
And it just makes it really hard because you're constantly going, it's Russell Crowe in a fat suit. And it completely impairs his performance. Physically, it impairs his performance. And so it just feels like you're watching a weird kind of parody or something, when actually this, as you two are saying, this should be super compelling. This, the meat at the heart of this story, it's a fascinating part of American media culture that has now become a part of American political culture and American culture generally. Like, it's massive, this story.
It is huge.
And to your point, Boyd, it was just a bit boring. I was like, yeah. I found it really hard to get to the end of the
really
episode.
It's really unself-aware, and they make a really big deal about how they announce on television that Fox News is going to be fair, objective and balanced. And of course, that is the last thing in the world it is. But the problem is that this show is not objective, fair or balanced. I'm never going to defend Roger Ailes for any reason, but they put him up as this really two-dimensional boogeyman with no redeeming features. And while that may be true, everyone has something, like a motivation, something you can latch onto and sympathise with. And they don't even attempt to find what the motivations are beyond megalomaniacal greed.
I actually wanted it to be more kind of opinionated in a way. Like, I thought it was weirdly
more damning.
I thought I know what you're saying. The way the portrayal of him is just so down the line and obvious.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. What do we know about Roger Ailes? He created the right wing TV network, and he abused women.
Yeah.
Right. And so he's never going to be a good guy, right?
But
the way it tells
you want complex characters.
Well,
I just want
an angle. I didn't feel there's even an angle. It's just showing what we know. We all know those things. There was no great insight. I think that's what it's lacking. What is driving him? Did he really believe? I mean, there are six more episodes.
Yeah.
But I actually watched some of episode two, and I'm like, this is just carrying on being like this. It's like they're actually. I felt they needed more. It needs to be even more extreme in its condemnation, or
If you do that, material that shows you what. He's done this terrible thing, and he's done this other terrible thing.
Yeah.
But behind him being terrible, he's also an evil genius. Then make him an evil genius.
Right, 100%.
But he's not an evil genius. He's quite a bumbling wrong'un.
And so when he's just going about his daily business, he's kind of just kind of nothing.
Sounds like he's a chump. He's blagging it,
and then he gets furious in the meetings but none of it quite fits together. There's no sense of why he is like he is. Does he, you know, what does he actually believe in?
It's every decision he makes in it seems to be a bit ill-conceived, hiring Sean Hannity, and who actually it turns out is a bit shit when he hires him, and everyone thinks, what are you doing? And even Rupert Murdoch's a bit like, you're doing a terrible job, and it's like, okay, and again, maybe
That's the other thing that's Rupert Murdoch, certainly in this episode, is like the voice of reason. I've got to stop there. Any drama where fucking Murdoch, even in if it's just in the first episode, he's like the one keeping things together and the one saying what's really going on. No, that's not going to work.
No, indeed. So that is The Loudest Voice. It airs on Sky Atlantic and Now TV on Thursday, September the 5th at 9 p.m. Finally, though, this week we have what I think is a genuine oddity in terms of television. This is Nick Hornby's State of the Union, and it's a quite curious collection of 10-minute shorts directed by Stephen Frears and starring Rosamund Pike, a.k.a. Moiraine Damodred of the Aes Sedai, and Chris O'Dowd as a couple going through relationship counselling. Now, each short takes place in the 10 minutes prior to their sessions. You don't see the counselling. And despite being set in the UK and made by people from this side of the pond, this aired in May, I think, back in the US on Sundance TV. But it is here now, and it is, honestly, as witty and all-round delightful as I think you would pretty much hope from all of these people. I absolutely love this. I've watched the first five of them. I'm absolutely going to watch the next five. It's genius, and it's essentially just a two-hander between O'Dowd and Pike in a pub. When this started, when it began, I was a bit like, ooh. And the thing that kind of put me off initially, just very, very briefly, was I thought there was a touch of word salad to it. You know, a touch of it's very, very witty and very, very, not overwritten, but very precisely written. And Nick Hornby, who's an incredibly good writer, is clearly very proud of his dialogue. And my whole thing was, you know, like how our early Kevin Smith movies had this, like Clarks and Mallrats and stuff. It's like, humans don't talk like this. But actually, that, you know, if that even bothers you at all, which it probably won't, lasts all of about 10 seconds, because they are both incredibly likable, incredibly funny. And even though they are going through this marital strife and they both have their legitimate grievances, the way they put those grievances across, I think, is both real and true and believable. And also really, really funny and really, really poignant. It's very bittersweet. And I found myself just finding them both delightful company, and the fact that they go from airing their differences with each other, you know, picking holes in each other's personality as, you know, couples do. There's grievances about past misdeeds. There's been an infidelity, but then equally they'll come together to talk about another couple that they see coming out of the counselling office, or talking about someone else, or they run into a pair of friends. Ashley B turns up randomly at one point. It's you know, it's really, really good and really, really honest. And I absolutely love this.
I didn't watch it because I ran out of time.
Thanks, Terry.
All I'm going to say... You hadn't even noticed that we were going to do it.
Oh, no,
it
was, I didn't notice.
Literally 10 minutes long.
I know, but I literally ran out of time. Yeah.
All right, boy, did you like it?
That's annoying because I'm really intrigued as to whether Terry's going to like it or not.
I'll tell you one thing.
Like, it is fucking middle class, I'll tell you.
Oh, it's the most middle class.
It's the most middle class thing I've seen. But the brilliant thing that perhaps it's saving grace. Well, no, I mean, I love it, by the way, but the casting is genius because Chris O'Dowd, because he is in his Irish accent, he doesn't come across as particularly middle class. So you're like, oh, okay. So even though, you know, everything's kind of set in this like gastro pub and they're on their way to counselling and all of the references are unbelievably middle class, everything that they say and do, it's still, he grounds it, gives it an
earthy quality to it. And also, the argument they have about Brexit is genius because it turns out he voted Leave essentially, and that kicks off, and then it becomes a metaphor for their whole marriage, and it's just geniusly put together.
Yeah. And that's in episode two when the Brexit thing comes in, which is brilliant, and that does, and it is called State of the Union, and that does you from then you're constantly thinking, oh, this is a metaphor. And what's really interesting is you never quite know, or at least I've watched three episodes, you never quite know the extent to which they still like or don't dislike each other. That is really well done. The state of their relationship, the state of the union is fascinating, and kind of their issues with each other. And the way that, because there's another couple, they keep, so a lot of it is, the brilliant thing is there's another couple who they observe, who go to the shows before they do, and they observe them and they're behaving really weirdly and they're trying to work out what they're doing, or we're trying to work out what the main central couple we're watching are doing. It's really clever and smart, and even though, and I think he's done a brilliant job, Nick Hornby, of writing it, and Stephen Frears, even though he fell asleep in one of my BAFTA Q&As, has done a brilliant job of directing it. I really like it.
It stands, the simplicity of this is its genius. Each one is 10 minutes long, but it just shows what happens when you have really great, razor sharp, hyper articulate writing and two incredibly charismatic and capable performers. Because I think it really is, you know, those two, you know, this dialogue is very, very witty, but it requires a subtlety and it requires a lightness of touch. And I think they both really nail it.
I
found this quite delightful, actually.
Delightful.
Delightful.
Quite delightful.
I found it quite delightful.
Talking
a little bit delightful.
James finds it quite delightful.
I've already gone off it.
No, but this is good. Now this airs on BBC Two, and it's Sunday, September the 8th. It starts now. Is it when are we seeing them? Are they dropping every day? Are they?
No,
how is
so
it
they're showing it in double bills weekly.
Okay, so essentially you get 20 minutes a week.
No. But you can watch the whole thing. It'll arrive on iPlayer that night as well.
Oh, do that then.
So you can watch the whole thing.
It's much more fun to binge. This is.
Yeah.
It's great fun. Highly recommend State of the Union. What would be? Terry's kind of disqualified from Pick of the Week, but for having not watched everything. But what would be your Pick of the Week of the things you saw?
The Capture.
Boyd?
Oh, The Capture, yeah.
Oh, mine was State of the Union.
Oh, okay.
I loved it. I think it's really, really good. But anyway, all good, all worth watching, apart from the one that isn't. So, Banshee. You didn't have one last week. I can't help but notice. I won't hold that against you. Clearly, only one holding this franchise together.
I mean, in so many ways.
Yeah. Boyd, do you have a thing?
I do have a thing this
Go
week.
On.
I was inspired by your story, James. I wanted to do, I thought, there must be a show in my mind that is all about the heroics of journalism. I wanted a journalist hero, defiant against all the bad guys and the enemy, a kind of voice of liberal reason. And what I remembered was a show which was genuinely a favourite of mine growing up called Lou Grant. Did you ever watch Lou Grant?
Rings a bell, but I don't know if I did.
The number of people who don't know Lou Grant.
What is it?
Lou Grant starred Ed Asner. It started in 1977 and went on for quite a few series. And it was actually, Ed Asner is the editor of a newspaper, the titular Lou Grant. And it was a spin-off, unbelievably, from the Mary Tyler Moore Show, which was a sitcom, a legendary sitcom. Yeah. And the spin-off of that, Rhoda, was another spin-off of that, which is another legendary sitcom. All of these shows I loved. Rhoda was my favourite comedy growing up. But Lou Grant was a drama. So what they took a character from a sitcom, spun it off and turned it into an hour-long drama series. It was a really weird thing
That's
to do.
That's tripping.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if anyone's ever done it since, but it worked really
isn't
well.
Isn't this like Machete with Danny Trejo was spun out of Spy Kids?
Oh, my God.
Oh my God.
Should I not say Machete?
I'm glad you did, but it's not like that at all, no.
I mean, he's meant Mexican.
Yeah.
And that was clearly Japanese.
Exactly.
You know.
Yeah.
No, but, oh, anyway.
But it was created by James L. Brooks of Broadcast News fame. It's about the journalism, the heroic nature of journalism, and it's really good and entertaining, and it was great.
Oh, okay. No, I've never heard of that, it turns out.
No, good.
All right, fine.
That's hence the point of Banshee.
That's good. It's good. It's good. Like the way you tied that back to my own heroic efforts on the part of journalism. Mine is... Oh, Terry's standing up. What's going on?
My bum's gone numb.
Okay. I wanted to talk about the Lenny Henry show. Oh, God, Terry's right on.
Terry's face is a picture.
No. So, the Lenny Henry show. No, let me justify it. Wait till I finish. Don't start attacking me. Yet. So, the Lenny Henry show obviously began as a sketch show in 1984, but I would like to speak about the 2 years from 1987 onwards where it became a sitcom. Terry staring at me. Okay, fine. So, the sitcom incarnation of this, in which the Tiswas veteran and Dudley-born comedian, Lenny Henry, played pirate radio DJ Delbert Wilkins. Yes, it's true. So who ran his radio show out the back of Alex Kazoblis' kebab shop. Vaz Blackwood was in this as Winston, his kind of right-hand man. Gina McGee was in this as one of as a waitress working in the restaurant. And it was really, really good. Like this, it kind of consisted of him in sort of outrageous coloured suits, with a really weird rhombus-shaped haircut and this macaw-like laugh that
he
had.
This is the most unlikely Banshee.
But also, I'm enjoying the fact he's talking about, like, he's the only person who's ever discovered this. Please tell me more about Delbert Wilkins, James.
No, but I don't think this is as well-known as you think it is.
Oh, my God.
I'm going to say a significant number of people...
I made a Delbert Wilkins reference on Twitter last year and my replies were flooded.
All right, maybe I'm wrong then. I just assumed that not a lot of people knew Delbert Wilkins. I really enjoyed the show. I thought it was great, you know.
Tell us more about, what was his name? Lenny?
I hate
what
you.
What was it?
I think it's his birthday today.
You know how, like, it's just because he used to introduce brilliant new adjectives like crucial and spondicious. Remember he had that thing, that Delbert Wilkins Guide to Cruciality, that's a camera
bit. We remember all of it. This is not your discovery. Oh my God.
Fine. Whatever.
I hate you all.
What is happening?
I got thinking about Lenny Henry on the weekend. I can't remember what it was, but he popped up and I was like, oh my God, Delbert Wilkins. So that made me want to bring it up on the podcast.
So I'd like to Banshee Vicar of Dibley.
Oh, you're
the long lost
withering sarcasm is
long lost.
Only false lost.
You may not have heard of it. So basically, she's like a vicar, right? But she's like a lady vicar,
right?
Which is like what makes it so like revolutionary.
And who's in that, Terry? Do tell.
Oh my God, I've forgotten her name.
Aha! Ironically, was married to Lenny Henry, Dawn French.
Dawn French.
Yes.
She's a comedian.
Yes, I know, yes.
She sometimes does something with another female comedian.
Did you ever watch Girls on Top?
Oh, God. Yes. No, please tell
you
me about
that. I mean, that would have had slightly more validity, Girls
really?
On Top.
You think that was less seen than Delbert Wilkins?
Yeah, it was, because that was the first thing a lot of those people did. Yeah,
I
should have done
bet
Girls on
you
Top.
Loads of people listening to this have never heard of Delbert Wilkins. Anyway, well, you can't buy it, but you can. All the Delbert Wilkins episodes are on YouTube. So if you haven't seen it, you can watch it there.
Will you do Blackadder next week?
Can we just rename this segment, like James gets pilloried for trying to, you know, spread a bit of love to the world?
Oh, can I just, when we rename this section, James doesn't understand the rules of his own franchise?
Yeah.
Right. Okay, anything else you'd like to add before we go?
No.
Well, apart from Boyd has to win Banshee, though I've never heard of that and it sounds a bit shit. Because your really thing good. Is so not valid.
We should mention it in the new issue. We haven't done
yes.
that.
So on Thursday next week, actually this week, because this will be going out on Monday, the new issue of Pilot TV is out with Empire Magazine, which, by the way, has the world exclusive for The Irishman with Martin Scorsese, Robert De Niro, Al Pacino and Joe Pesci on the cover. But we also have Pilot TV, and in Pilot TV this issue we have a massive special on the upcoming 2 years/25 decades of Marvel television. Boyd writes an amazing angry love letter to the OA. He interviews Cillian Murphy, Helen Mirren, basically interviewed everybody in the magazine, Boyd, I wasn't realising the other day. We've got American Horror Story, we've got Bodies, which is a really great piece in James' section about Gone Too Soon, Frasier, Seinfeld, The Politician. It is a cracking issue, if you'd like.
Is there anything on Delbert Wilkins?
To buy it. I'm sure there's going to be something in the next issue, bearing in mind how obsessed you now are with Delbert fucking Wilkins.
My favourite thing is the thing about Seinfeld, a little obscure show which maybe you could be doing on the
Bantry
next week.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
two are the bell ends on this show, I have to say.
My God.
Right, that is it for another episode of the Pilot TV podcast. If you enjoyed it, I certainly didn't, but if you enjoyed it, then don't give us a 5-star rating. No, instead, come and tell us how much you like it in person. Friday, 13th September, King's Place in London. We are doing this live and we'd love you to be here. So head over to kingsplace.co.uk and book yourself some tickets. Boyd's close personal friend, Russell Tovey, will be on. He'll tell you all about all kinds of embarrassing stories from Boyd's misspent youth while we all laugh at him. So that's something to look forward to. Who doesn't want to see that? We'll be back next week with more of the same, assuming, that is, I make it back as Glutton for Punishment. As I said, I am back in the US next week. So the next time you hear from me, it could well be live from a holding cell at an airport. Let's hope they have the Lenny Henry Show. Pilot out.